And tonight's speaker comes to us from Covington, and he just celebrated 20 years. So I'm very excited to hear a lot of what it's like now. And with that, we have Doug.
I'm Doug. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Doug.
I don't know when I first realized I might be an alcoholic. I don't even remember my first drink, but I do remember the first time realized that I might have a different relationship with it than other people. I was probably 9 or 10 years old. I was with my brother and a few of his friends, and they had kind of talked me into playing quarters with them, and they were doing shots of whiskey. I think they did it as like a joke, or like laughing at me or make fun of me. That's my brother, I should say. He was 5 years older than me, so they're a bit, you know, they were teenagers. What I found out was that, I'm not very good at quarters. None of us were. We all ended up getting drunk, but at the end of it, the only two that didn't tap out was me and my brother. And I remember not so much the buzz, the alcohol buzz, but the feeling that gave me, which was kind of like acceptance. It made me feel like made me feel bigger somehow, because I knew that I could like hold alcohol, and I don't know where that came from. Thank you. But it was certainly there. And I think part of that is, you know, in that context, I think I always remember feeling kind of a little bit at dis-ease, like socially. And I don't really understand that either, because I had social skills, but I always just kind of felt other and didn't really feel like a part of like groups and stuff. In alcohol, I think that was my first recognition that it kind of did that for me. So, naturally, I continued to do that. I sought it out, you know, and I was just a child. I was like 10 years old. and so that would kind of evolve as I went on. There's drugs in my story. In part, at that age, it's easier to get drugs than it is alcohol. You know, that's, you know. But I think alcohol was probably always primary, you know, with my different addictions, because it kind of started there. It kind of, you know, we refer to alcoholism as a disease, and that's exactly how I think of my disease. It's dis-ease. That's when I know that my alcoholism is present. Is when I'm feeling dis-ease, usually in social settings. You know, it's a reminder to check me and to dig into my recovery. So, growing up, thinking back on it, alcohol and or drugs were always a part of, like, all my social activities. I was really into music. I played in bands and stuff, and so that kind of was all, you know, part of that lifestyle. So, while I think I was probably self-medicating to some extent, it still had kind of an innocent character to it, or at least as I think back on it, because I guess just the consequences weren't there. It actually worked. But then, like, a series of events as I got older happened that kind of took it in a different direction. The first of those was like, I guess I was 16 and my best friend died in a tragic car wreck. And, you know, at that age, you just lose, you know, like a first real experience with death. It just kind of changes the way you look at the world. We all experience that, but given my proclivity to alcohol and drugs, I began to, you know, I think my use began to accelerate. And then, you know, I was also like heavy into like the punk rock scene, which was basically all about nihilism and kind of, you know, self-indulged debauchery. That was kind of the scene that I was wrapped up in. I was 18 years old. my brother passed away,
And this was a really significant event in my life, in my family's life. Because I always kind of idolized him. I always looked up to him. And, I mean, he's the one that first exposed me to alcohol, drugs, all of that. The way that he passed, we don't know exactly, but it was ruled suicide by Russian roulette. You know, as hard as that was, losing my big bro, you know, watching my family, my parents go through that was devastating. You know, there's no doubt that the worst pain, the worst emotional pain that is in the human experience is you know, loving parents losing a young child. You know, I just, you know, to see that up front was, you know, up close was, you know, pretty intense. And so my addiction, you know, really stepped up at that point. And, you know, I remember for a period of time trying to put the brakes on all of that, I think in deference to my parents, and maybe out of respect for my brother, and that maybe lasted a couple of months. But when I kind of resumed, you know, the kind of weekend partying and whatever else I could, you know, get hold of stuff turned into like a full time, you know, and I was seeking like absolute oblivion. So there was alcohol, there was drugs, there was heroin, opiates, you know, IV drug use, all of that stuff. And I guess that went on pretty intensely for about 2 years. So let's see, time, I was 18 when Chris passed away, so yeah, until I was about 20, and then I landed myself, I'd driven to Austin to stay with a friend. I was trying to get away from drugs, and I went to Austin, Texas to detox. And if you've been to Austin, it's kind of, you know, it's funny, right? It's the most drug-free place in America, for sure. Well, like a good guess, I was there maybe 3 days, and I don't know, I ate a bunch of pills, I don't even, it doesn't matter what it was, but like blackout, went to go buy drugs, got there, I don't remember any of this because I was blacked out, but drove up into somebody's yard in a residential area, I didn't even know this town, and passed out. And I guess I was blocking their driveway, so naturally they called the police to have this intruder removed. And this is what I do remember. I remember waking up and there being a cop rapping on the window with a flashlight, you know. And it was getting dark, and I'm not knowing, being disoriented, not knowing where I was, not knowing what was going on. I just knew that I was in a car, and it was in a truck. It was locked, and the cops were telling me to get out. And I was going, no, I'm getting out. Finally, they cracked the window and pulled me out of there, and I got arrested for some drug charges. I can't remember, there was like a resisting arrest and some other silly stuff, but anyways, I was forced into sobriety, probably for the first extended time, via criminal justice system, got into like a diversion treatment program through the jail, and then ended up getting out and going to a private treatment center, and you know, trying to do recovery, I wanted to get sober, but I don't think it was, I think mostly it was because I realized what was happening with my parents after watching, you know, them go through that with my brother. I knew that I was torturing them, you know, that they just buried their eldest. And here I was, I mean, they knew what was going on. They'd heard through the grapevine, there'd been multiple overdoses. You know, I was flirting with death for sure. And, you know, I don't need to get too into it, but I was, like, pretty, pretty hardcore. I was recklessly, you know, my drug use, I wasn't kidding myself of what I was doing. I mean, I was seeking absolute, total oblivion. There was no denial of my addiction or, you know, trying to cover that up. I was all in. So when I ended up in treatment and was first exposed to, you know, this program and other programs, but the 12 steps, you know, I was trying to do it. I was trying to do it, but I was 20 years old. In hindsight, I don't think I truly understood what the program was. I intellectually understood it. I the treatment center I went, I memorized the 12 steps. I knew all of these details. You know, they really made you study the book. You get into this stuff, and I understood it, but I don't think it ever really anchored. I don't think it ever really connected. I think probably immaturity, and part of it was that I was doing this for somebody else, and that just doesn't work. You know, it might get you in the doors, but it's not gonna keep you here. So, you know, I ended up staying sober. How long? Probably it was about 4.5 years. I mean, I'm skipping over some stuff. There was a few slips, but I did end up staying sober for about 4.5 years, and I'd moved to Arizona. With my girlfriend, and the plan was, you know, we're going to go to school and work and all that stuff, and she was in recovery too, but she was struggling, and she would make it like 6 months and slip, and we were living together, and, you know, financially, I was kind of trapped because couldn't afford an apartment without a girlfriend. I loved her, but, you know. You know, I'm staying sober. I think when this really started happening, I remember being about 2 years sober, and, you know, I'd find needles and spoons and stuff, and it's just not a great environment. And, you know, this went on, but I had a sponsor, I was going to meetings, I was trying to do the deal, but ultimately, that relationship didn't work, and I had to move out. Moved to Phoenix. I was in Flagstaff at that time. We were living together. And like I said, I cared very deeply for this person, but it was like I knew that I was going to relapse if I didn't get out of there. Unfortunately, about the time that I left, we found out that she had a very serious form of cancer. It was Ewing sarcoma. It's like a very aggressive type of bone cancer. She got sick, and maybe 18 months later, she was gone. She died. She passed away. And at that point, I don't really know. I kind of think the relapse, that was more of the trigger. It's not the reason. I kind of think of relapse, looking back on it, as kind of working steps backwards. You stop working with other people. You stop, you stop prayer. You stop taking inventory. You stop being accountable. So next thing you know, you're not powerless anymore. So it was a process that probably had been going on for at least a year or so. But when she got really sick, Anyways, I went back out, and in my mind at that time, or what I was telling myself, was that I knew that I was a drug addict. There was no doubt about that. But I wasn't certain that I was an alcoholic. And when I think back on that, it's nonsense. Like, I knew. I don't think I was scared of alcohol like I was some of the other stuff. Well, when I went out, when I started drinking again, I learned a very painful lesson in that. So when I started drinking, you know, I was able to kind of control it for, I don't know, a month or two. I would drink, you know, just a couple of drinks, and I was able to do that for a couple of months. But when I started teetering, went straight into just full. I started drinking like I never drank before, and now I wasn't really doing drugs, I was drinking, but every time I drank, I would black out. And I would black out, and I would go to bars, and I would somehow pick a fight with somebody and proceed to get the crap beat out of me. Usually I would hit somebody, and this is mostly somebody telling me, and then somehow my, you know, pickled brain, I didn't recognize that person that I just hit for no good reason was with like five other people.
Yeah.
So that didn't work out too good for me. you know, and there's, yeah, I mean, it was scary. When I think of all my drug use, most of the drug use I did in the privacy of my own home, and while I was, you know, obviously flirting with some dangerous stuff, at least I was doing it in the privacy of my own home. Something about alcohol makes you want to go out in the public and share it with the world. Right. And so, there was a number of times I woke up on my couch. I remember waking up being covered in blood. Sometimes it was my blood. One time I flattened my mailbox on my motorcycle. I went right through the mailbox, and I guess face planted the mailbox, knocked it completely over, and then I guess just went inside and passed out on my couch. But I woke up and there was just dry blood all over me, and my lip was, you know, cut open. It's pretty obvious what happens. You went out, and mailbox is on the ground. There was at least two instances where I woke up covered in blood, and I wasn't hurt. So, I don't even know how to describe that. I mean, just like terrified. You don't know what you did. You don't know where you went. You don't know who's looking for you. So there was a period of probably a year, year and a half. It's a little fuzzy, but a little, yeah, probably a year and a half where I was drinking like that. And this would have been, 2004. May 15th, 2004 was actually my mother's birthday. And this is kind of crazy, but I'll tell you this before I get into subsequent events. But I was sitting outside my house smoking a cigarette, and this dove, like a perfectly white dove, landed right in front of me. And I'm not a religious person. Definitely was not a religious person at that time. But certainly know what the symbolism is of the white dove. You know, and this was not like a pigeon that was white-ish. This was like a perfect, picture-perfect white dove. And it flew down, landed, kind of looked at me, and then flew off. And I was like, huh. And being my mom's birthday, my mother, on the other hand, is very Christian, very religious. And so I called her on her birthday to tell her what happened. And she was like, that. And because I knew she would be touched by it. So, that night I went out with my girlfriend. She talked me into going to this party, and I didn't want to go, but she was like, "Well, I'll come pick you up. We'll go to this thing." So we went to this party. It was like a medical school graduation party. There was people I didn't know. They were her friends. I remember feeling the disease. Being in a social situation with a bunch of people that were not my people as far as I was concerned. They had beer, they had like kegs or whatever, but like a good party guest, I found the liquor cabinet that was not offered to me, and found a half gallon of Jack Daniels. And I don't remember a whole lot more about that evening. I remember that somebody had gotten escorts, like whoever it was, they were like strippers. And I got in trouble with my girlfriend, I guess, because I was at the party that she made me go to, and they were strippers, and I may have looked at them. Yeah. So there was a fight. There was some sort of a fight, which I don't really remember. And somehow I got the keys to her car, and I left, because she would get crazy, and of all my faults. I never put hands on a woman, and so it was like that, and I left in her vehicle. Don't remember any of this. The next thing I remember was coming out of a blackout in an interrogation room with five or six clearly detectives that are trying to get me to incriminate myself, informing that I had left someone dead on the side of the highway from a car accident. I don't really know how to describe that, because like I said, I don't remember the night. I don't remember anything about the evening. I don't remember getting in the car. I don't remember getting out of the car. I just remember coming out of a blackout, and there's cops asking me questions, and I'm being combative with them because that was just my nature when I was drunk and there was law enforcement involved. But once it kind of settled in what had happened, I can't, you know, pitiful, incomprehensible self-demoralization. I mean, I don't think, you know, those words and the way that Bill wrote it, I think that pretty much encapsulated as best as any words possibly could. You know, just my whole world fell apart. I was just completely, in that moment, broken emotionally, spiritually. Clearly, I was going to prison, you know, and I was at the tender age of, what, 28? I'm in Arizona. Arizona is one of two or three of the most hard, it just extreme in terms of sentencing in the criminal justice system. You don't want to get in trouble in Arizona. They're gonna lay you down for a long time. Well, I had. Evidently, I was driving down the highway. I don't know. I don't remember any of this. I just know what, you know, that they're telling me, that basically my car and this other car rubbed up against each other. So either I drifted into their lane, or maybe I was speeding and then they didn't see me and they tried to get into my lane, but we just rubbed. It wasn't like an impact, but the driver of that vehicle panicked and cut the wheel, which sent his vehicle into a flip. And the passenger, which was his pregnant wife, was ejected from the vehicle, and I was on the equivalent of like 285, like the perimeter of Phoenix. And so she was ejected, and there was like these cables dividing the road, and it basically decapitated her, killed her instantly. As we found out, she was 5 months pregnant. I didn't find out that information for a month or something. I was in jail. But, you know, as far as I was concerned, life was over. Like, I was just, I was horrified. I always knew that alcohol and drugs would kill me. It never occurred to me that I would end up killing someone else. I mean, we know the prophecy, you know, jails, institutions, and death. I guess I just assumed that the death would be mine and that I had maybe accepted that and was okay with that. I wasn't scared of it. But I wasn't okay with taking an innocent person's life because of my drunken recklessness. So, I went through a really dark period, I would say probably 6-9 months, which would have been county jail, Maricopa County, lovely place. I was suicidal. The only thing that, and I was not scared at all. I hear people say, like, I would have completely taken myself out. The only thing that kept me from doing that was, you know, my parents and knowing exactly what that would do to them, and that was not an option. I don't know exactly how it happened, but I had some sort of a moment of clarity that it was like I was either going to get busy living or I was going to get busy dying, and then in this environment, the addiction continues, but it's just exponentially worse. The jail, I should elaborate. The jail where I was at, I mean, all jails are full of drugs and alcohol and stuff, but Phoenix was just wild. I mean, it was just flooded. It was booze everywhere, but, you know, you get into debt in there, and it's all bad. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. It gets really ugly. So I knew that I had to find a way to get sober. I had experience with the program. And like I was saying, I don't think it really, you know, it didn't really anchor, I didn't really understand it, but now, I had lost everything. I think I was truly ready for sobriety. I was going to do it. I was going to do it one way or the other. And I did. I started drawing out, you know, there was booze, there was all this dope in there, and it kept coming through my cell and everything else. They had drilled holes through the wall, and they were fishing, you know, ounces of dope through a wall. It was like 4 foot thick. that I dried out in there. My sobriety date is February 5th, 2005. So I just made 20 years last month, which is wild. But sobriety day is my arrive at prison date. being transferred from county jail. And when I got to prison, I went to a level 4 yard in Arizona. At the time, there was a lot of stuff going on. It's a border state, and there's a lot of gangs, and there's just a lot of, you know, shouldn't have gone to a level 4 yard, given the nature of my crime. But at that time, the classification system was pretty jacked up. So they put me in the highest custody. And so I was in there with just straight-up gangbangers, straight-up killers, you know. And, really harsh environment. You're seeing murders and suicides and riots and all of that stuff was a fairly regular, routine thing. But I think that the extreme nature of that environment was exactly what I needed, if I'm being honest. It motivated me in a way that I had to, like, jump into recovery. And there wasn't really AA meetings. They had meetings, you had to sign up to them, and you could only go to, you could go to, like, what do they call it, like, 10 sessions, I think they called it. And it was pretty much a punishment for people that had gotten caught with drugs or had dropped a dirty UA. So, I started doing recovery the best that I understood it, and most of that looked like doing service work, and it was difficult, you know, if you went talking about, you know, Bill Wilson's way to some random guy on the yard, you'd probably get punched in the face. You just weren't going to do that. But there was so many opportunities, there were so many people in need, so just trying to help people. I had this wonderful blessing in getting a job in the GED school, and I started, you know, I got to get out of my cell every day and go and, you know, help people with basic algebra and geometry and stuff. And I remember I met this little dude, and I remember working with him, helping with his math, and he was struggling with it. And then I remember him, you know, seeing that look on his face and seeing the wheels turn and it starting to click, you know, and I got this sense of, like, peace, purpose, sense of fulfillment, maybe even joy. You know, it was fleeting. It only lasted, you know, a few minutes, but it was like in that moment I got it. I got what the program was about and what this was for. It, like, clicked. This is what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, and it's helping other people in whatever way I can. And that's the answer. Of course, this is all in our literature. It's right there in front of us, but it had never really resonated until that time. And so, you know, I didn't get into telling you the sentence, but I got sentenced to 13 years. This is Arizona. Per that, I had to do 85% of that, so that's 11 years. And the entire time I was in there, I was constantly trying to help people any way I could. There was only so much stuff that I could do, but I had basically given myself permission to forgive myself for what I'd done as long as I committed to doing everything that I could do in my limited power to be a good human being. And that was, like, physical fitness, helping other people, and education. And that's how I did my time. And I was constantly doing it in any way that I could. And, man, I stayed sober. And I also, not only did I stay sober about, it was probably 3 years into it, I remember thinking that, you know, even though the state of Arizona definitely owns my ass, my mind and spirit is probably more free than I've ever been in my life. You know, so, I mean, the promises that we that we talk about in here was like actually coming true in a maximum security prison, you know? And it carried me through that. Taking that on and staying with that, it carried me through that sentence. I got released in 2015, October 1st, 2015, which is almost 10 years ago, which blows my mind. Getting out was in many ways more difficult than going in. But I was determined to hit the ground running, get involved in business, get involved, you know. I got out, continuing on with service. My family and I opened up a sober living house, trying to, you know, specifically help people that had gotten wrapped up in the criminal justice system, you know, doing service where you're best equipped to do it. You know, people that had been through the same sort of circumstances as me, or worse, infinitely worse. I started working with my family, and then I ended up going to grad school. It took me probably 2 years to kind of chill out. You know, I was a little wired a little tight. I think that's fairly everybody has the long term incarceration. I ended up doing it was 11 years. So when I got back and started readjusting, you know, trying to balance stuff, focusing on recovery, but also, you know, trying to create a career, trying to do all those things. But it started coming together very slowly, not in my time frame, but here I am 10 years later, and it's, you know, this getting 20 years. If I'm being honest, sometimes I almost feel like it's almost like I have imposter syndrome or something. Like it doesn't feel real. I got a lot of benefits of. I think that my bottom, at least for me, was so intense that some of it was like once I came out of that fog, I was already kind of seeing the world in a different way. It's just like the brutality of it just knocked. It kind of knocked my head into a different state of consciousness. Which is not to say that I was cured or fixed or any way. It's just that, I look back at it, you know, and then there's so many people. I survived so many things. I'm just like, why am I here? Well, only thing I can come away with is there's got to be a reason, and it's to pay it forward and to continue giving to other people. And what I've found is I did the other steps so that I can do the 12th step. And the one thing that has been my saving grace is, when all else fails, working with another alcoholic, working with another addict, it gets me out of my stuff, man. And I feel good. And, am I happy, joyous, and free? Yes, when I remind myself to be. It's as simple as this program, the tools, allows me to process things and have and be at peace with them, with the outcomes, very quickly. But I will forget if I don't stay, doing the program, working with others, talking to others, staying connected. I will get off in La La Land and get all blown out, all ticked off for no good reason. That's still there. That will always be there. But the difference is, I recognize it, and I can see it coming. So misery is completely optional at this point. You know, there was a time where it was not. I was just fighting to get air, to stay above water. Today, life is whatever I want to make it. And, opportunities like this pop up. Hopefully somebody will hear, share the message, my struggles. The guy that I talked about teaching him, in GED school, teaching him math, I probably sponsored, 15 different people while I was incarcerated. To my knowledge, he's the only, half of them I know for a fact are dead, the rest of them are in prison. But that boy is now 15 years sober. Not only that, he's running a treatment center in Arizona. He's making six figures with half a GED, straight out of the street, no family. You know, my family basically adopted him. And if he's the one person that came out the other side of it that I worked with, it makes it all worth it. Because he's helping hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And I mean, that just, you know, that just sets my heart free. I think that's a good place to stop.
Thank you so much, Doug. Thank God for the things that get us in the door and lives we don't want to escape from.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Take me where the promise.